and welcome to Alzheimer Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm so excited that you're joining us today. We are going to have a fascinating conversation, as usual, as we learn from people all around the world at all ages and stages of life. Stay tuned as we shift our dementia care from crisis to comfort.
Here we go. What you think about?
Well, hi, everyone. I'm Lori LeBay, your host on Alzheimer Speaks Radio, and I'm thrilled you can join us today. We're going to have a really interesting conversation about protecting our elders and multiple ways that one group is doing that. I think you will find not only interesting, but useful to yourself and to others. For those of you that are new to Alzheimer Speaks Radio, we are about sound information, not just sound bites. We like to have real conversations with real people in the trenches. And so maybe, just maybe, you can be our next guest. Everyone around the world is welcome. The only one true thing that I hold to is we have to have a respectful conversation. And to me, I find that fairly easy to do. I don't think we all have to totally agree 100% with others. It's about learning and listening to options and others' beliefs and understandings of things that make this world a better place. Now, for those of you that don't know, also Alzheimer's Speaks is kind of our main platform, and there you can go visit. We have one section that is just full of free resources. So you'll find everything from being able to access the radio shows and dementia chats, dementia quick tips, to dementia in the arts, a poetry section, learn about dementia-friendly communities and memory cafes and the Purple Angel, as well as accessing Dementia Map, which is a global resource directory that has over 150 categories that you can check out. Let's see. I also want to mention my book is finally going to be launched here, probably not till February, but we're taking pre-orders at this time, called Betty the Bald Chicken, Lessons in How to Care. And it's written as a children's book, but I think the kids are going to teach the adults an awful lot about this. I would also highly recommend that you check out the Adaptive Equipment and Caregiving Corner, as well as the Footbar Walker. And again, you can always go to alzheimerspeaks.com for information on both of those. So let's get this party started and let's pull in our guests so we can learn about Elder Care IQ as well as Elder Voice Family Advocates. So Chris Sundberg is with us today and I am so excited to have her. I have heard about her and her work for years from various colleagues, one of those being Alan Caspi, who is a good friend to Alzheimer Speaks and Dementia Chats. And Chris is the executive director of Elder Care IQ and Elder Voice Family Advocates, which are a nonprofit organization. As an award-winning former executive and corporate officer in Fortune 100s and entrepreneurial companies, she brings just a great extensive background in terms of management, communication, and public affairs. So, Chris, I can't wait to hear about what you are doing in the world of our elders. So thanks so much for making the time for us today.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate you giving me time.
So Chris, I always like to start out asking everybody if they've been touched personally by dementia in their own family or circle of friends.
Well, not dementia per se, but elder abuse is definitely where my experience came from. My dad's body was left for 7 days without any wellness check in his room. And I happened to be out of the country in a location with very poor internet access. So I hadn't communicated with him all week. When I got back is when I learned he had passed away. His body was there. A neighbor across from him asked the staff, "Would you please go check on him? I haven't seen him." And they poo-pooed her and said, he's fine. We just saw him. Newspapers were piling up outside his door, yet it didn't occur to anybody to check. And we had been told that if he didn't come to the noon meal, they would go and check on him. So definitely had a false sense of security with that. And it was after that that I really learned how poorly regulated this business is. And that's when my eyes were opened. I realized how naive I was, how much I took for granted, how much I believed what they told me. And I was, you know, the typical consumer of that time, poorly informed. So we formed together and started Elder Voice Advocates.
Wow, that's a horrible story, but I appreciate you sharing that. So because we all believe what we're told, and you know, we take for granted that that is going to be upheld too, and is common sense, and you know, sometimes that isn't the way things play out. So I'm assuming that is why you created Elder Voice Advocates. How did you find other people like yourself?
Yeah, actually, I would give credit to Susie Scheller. She's an elder law attorney who brought a group of family members who had gone through some traumatic experience, you know, in long-term care with usually their parent, and brought us together. And we started out sort of as a self-help group, but quickly moved on from that and really wanted to make change. And my background is, you know, government affairs, public relations, this sort of thing. So I immediately turned toward, we need to fix this regulatory system. It was a shambles here. And so we knew we needed to organize and get an organization together. This handful of people that included Elon Caspi and Susie Scheller, our elder law attorney, and Gene Peters and Kay Brommelkamp were the key members that really came together. We had others as well, and we formed, and we quickly took action. It's been a whirlwind 5 years. And to be honest, Laurie, I'm shocked we got accomplished what we did. And it's a lot of good fortune, tenaciousness.
I think when you have passion behind you, it drives so much better than even a budget, even a big budget, because you feel it in the heart. Yeah. That this is important and it has to make a difference come hell or high water. And you just kind of have that mindset. We're going to cut through the thick of this. Now you're located in Minnesota, like I am. Was everybody else in Minnesota as well?
Yeah. Yes. And Elon now has moved from the state, but he's still on our board of directors. And we came together and we really quickly started our work. You know, one of the first things that we did is first of all, we knew we wanted to change the laws. So that was our biggest priority when we started. And that required us to do several things, kind of learn all the issues, kind of learn the system and make sure that we were educated and competent in what we were going to be recommending. The biggest thing is allowing people to tell their story. It was huge. That is probably the single most important factor in our success, is family members came forward, they talked to the media, they talked to legislators, they testified in committees, and that was the first time I think they really had a face on this really unknown issue. It was the best kept secret around. And I was hellbent that we're going to take away the smoke and the mirrors. And that's what we have been. When you mentioned, you know, it's that passion. And that's exactly what's energized everybody who's involved. Because we're largely volunteer driven. We've been able to get some more funding the last few years, but the first 2 years, I mean, we started on $1,000 in the bank. but we had some core talents in our group that enabled us to really get a lot done on a shoestring.
I think when you get that passion together, and you know, there's so many more resources than just money that people forget about. It's contacts, it's skill sets, it's, you know, it's all of those types of things that make a huge, huge difference and can really catapult you forward in ways that sometimes big organizations with large budgets can't do. And you don't have any political tie-ins, you know, or, you know, bureaucracy that you have to, well, no, we can't do that because that might tick off somebody. And we can't say that because we have to, you know, they're big donors of ours. Because a lot of times that stuff comes into play well. And I've run into that just with my own company, Alzheimer's Speaks. People go, how do you do what you do? How do you get so much done? And it's like, I don't have to answer to anybody but me. You know, it's really simple. And when you have that attitude, which I'm assuming you guys have, we're going to do something is better than nothing, even if it's not perfect. We're going to get it out there and we're going to get known and we're going to elevate and create awareness. And when you said, you know, letting people tell their stories, I think stories are life-changing in so many fashions for not only, you know, the people going through this, but people who are thinking about their elders of what could happen and what are some questions to ask and where are some resources to check and things. But let's get back, because I know, so with the law, what happened here in Minnesota law-wise once you guys stepped forward and met with Congress and things?
Well, we have to back up a little before the law, because the first thing that really happened were two important things. We started telling our stories to the media, and that was key. And the more the Star Tribune covered a lot of those stories, and in December of 2017, Chris Sears had that five-part series, Left to Suffer. Horrific, horrific stories. And many of those were people, members of Elder Voice. And that jarred the dome off of the state capitol. I mean, it just shocked people that this was happening. Then to add on to that, we requested a legislative audit be done of the Office of Health Facilities Complaints, which is within the Department of Health. It was a shambles. It was a mess. People trying to get accountability and get investigations, often nothing happened. It got ignored. They were caught, a staff person was caught throwing 2,000 complaints in the garbage. Directly in the garbage. It was all a paper-based system. And at that point, there were 22,000 complaints a year coming in. No paper-based system can handle that. That's unreal. And by the way, that was a 560-some percent increase from 2010 to 2018. So in 2010, we had about 4,000 complaints. By 2018, it was 22,500 complaints. Now, that's the last year we have available in complaint data, but it's just astronomical. The problems going on in long-term care are just astronomical. So we needed to bring awareness to that. And the Governor Dayton called together Alzheimer's Association, the AARP, Legal Aid and Elder Justice Center, and then us brand new little organization, Elder Voice Advocates. I mean, I was astounded that we were brought to the table. The other thing he did that was so unique is he only had advocates. For once, the providers weren't domineering the story here. And he purposefully designed it that way. And so that hit, the newspaper story hit in November Governor Dayton calls us in early December of that year and says, I'd like you to give us some legislative recommendations. And oh, by the way, session starts in a month and a half. Everybody was just phenomenal, just sat down, really worked it out. And we did more than just bring recommendations. We brought language, legislative language to him. He accepted every single piece of our recommendations. And we weren't able to get the law passed in 2018 because we had a split House and Senate. The Senate was controlled by the Republicans, or actually it wasn't split at that time. It was controlled by the Republicans, both Senate and House. And they wouldn't even give us a hearing, not even a hearing. So we had the elections in 2018, which then changed where we had the split houses, one Republican, one Democrat. And then in the meantime, that we had requested a legislative audit, that report came out and it was scathing, absolutely mind-blowing. And it was so concerning to the auditors that they called a meeting with the then commissioner and said, these are life-threatening problems that have to be addressed. You need to change things now. So that happened. They also, another outstanding thing from our point of view is that commissioner left, and that's when Jan Malcolm was brought in. Phenomenal leader, phenomenal. She really did the elders so much. Helped out in that she cleared the playing field. She mandated that the industry folks, the advocates, and all the agencies get together in the same room, and all through 2019, hammer out legislation that we all would agree upon. And I entered that thinking, we'll get a few crumbs here and there, you know. She sat with that group. We spent hundreds of hours. She was in that same room making sure that that playing field stayed level, that our voices were being heard just as much as the industry voices have been heard for decades in the past. And we all had to sign off on this final language. Nobody got everything they wanted, and it got passed with only one vote in opposition to it.
Wow, that's incredible.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. And it's, you know, when you were talking about the complaints from 2010 going from 4,000 to 22,500 in 2018, I can't even imagine what it's like over COVID in that right. area with the staff shortages and things that are there. I'll ask this question later because I want you to keep going on other things that you have done, but that's incredible. What kinds of changes then took place because of legislation?
Well, the licensure of assisted living. Minnesota was the only state not to license assisted living, which is incredible. We view ourselves as such a progressive state, yet there we are, dead last. So important things that it did, it established care standards and infection control standards, new building standards, a bunch of protections, retaliation for one thing, or giving you a notice one day and being told you got to be out the next, that kind of stuff. It also allowed people to put cameras in their rooms and not notify the care provider if they suspected some abuse or neglect was happening. So they could put those cameras in for 2 weeks before having to notify the facility. the logic to that still escapes me, because why should they ever have to tell if there's a camera? But anyway, that's what we had to compromise with. So unfortunately, then that's when we get the pandemic. And those rules, those laws didn't go into effect until August 1st of 2021. So that left 2 years of very weak, you know, infection control was very, very weak in the long-term care industry. The care standards were very weak. The protections were trampled on routinely. So I really do wish that we had been able to get that much sooner, have been in place before the pandemic, because I think with some infection control protections, it maybe not so many would have had to die. We were terrible. I mean, over 80% in long-term care, 80% of the deaths happened to people in long-term care. And it's still, that's the prevalent group. But the pandemic, and I guess the other wrinkle I'll say too is early on in the pandemic, the Department of Health was all hands on deck to help. And the commissioner came to our organizations, Alzheimer's, AARP, Legal Aid, Elder Justice, and Elder Voice, and said, I've had to redeploy 90% of my staff to doing the taking care of the pandemic. I don't think I can get the rulemaking done by August of 2021. And the other organization said, oh, we understand, that's okay. And we said, I understand, but please find a way to get it done. Because if we don't, there's going to be more needless death and suffering. And Commissioner Malcolm went back and found a way to get it done and did it well. And I am forever grateful to her leadership on this entire issue. That required two intensive years of Susie Scheller's time and various others of us during the rulemaking, just to make sure that those laws were enforced as they were intended. And I have to say, I'm really pleased that much of our recommendations were adopted in rules. And so we're in pretty good shape at the moment.
Wow, those are some pretty significant changes that you got pushed through. And Jan, I think she was just an angel too, in terms of, she was always calm, you know, no matter what was going on, it seemed like, but she knew her stuff. She had been in the industry forever. She was well-respected. And that's absolutely unreal. So kudos to you guys for stepping up and making that happen. And I think, you know, when you said you were surprised Dayton put you on the committee, again, it's that passion. It's the story. It's I've been there. I know what this is like. I've lived it. Those are powerful, powerful statements. And once they're spoke, they're really hard to ignore, because people feel that stuff at a heart level themselves. And then it gets into the question of, how do I sleep at night if I'm not going to address this?
Exactly. And, you know, before I got involved, I consciously thought about, gee, it would be easier just to move on and try to forget this. And I thought, no, I know myself well enough. I can't move on knowing there's a mess here. And I think one of the other early decisions that we made from day one is we would never take money from the industry or in any way compromise our decision-making. We had to be totally independent. And to be honest, I've even been reluctant to go for state grants. Because again, I don't want us to be beholden to anybody, when then instead of making decisions for the well-being of the the residents were making decisions for the well-being of elder voice. And without taking care of the elders, sorry, that's just not a compromise we're going to make.
Well, and I think too, sometimes with the grants, and I'm not a grant person, but what I have heard over the years, and maybe this has changed, but once you write a grant, you have to stick to your parameters. Even if you identify, oh my gosh, we missed the mark here and we need to shift. You can't shift. You have to continue doing what you said you were going to do, even though you know it's not going to be effective, you know, and could even do some harm, I suppose, in some cases. And to me, that's just asinine, that there's not a slush pool where you can go back in and go. And again, maybe that has changed, but for years I heard that from people. And
I think what was became more challenging for us is after the George Floyd killing, mm-hmm. the foundations were, and rightfully so, you know, really funneling their attention and their dollars toward racial issues and, you know, equity issues. And it didn't leave a whole lot of room. On your point there, Lori, I haven't really experienced that. I felt like we got an understanding ear when things had to shift, because again, one of the things that makes us effective is we are able to shift quickly when circumstances change. And my gosh, in these last few years, wow, have they changed.
I'm saying that in regards to some grants where you're very much locked in, but you know, for an organization like yourself, I can tell just from talking to you, you're fluid, you're opening to listening. And to me, that's critical. Your storytelling and your truth telling, I call that emotional based training. And I think it shifts people from a mindset that they had to a heart set that they feel. And I think that to me makes the difference in the world in terms of pulling people together and pushing things forward. Because the motivation is at such a deep level. It's not something rote you've remembered or you've heard, but when you feel it, it doesn't go away.
It doesn't. And you know, if we're not out there speaking the truth, nobody will be. And one of the situations that we have now, we've got that law in place, that's great. We're still seeing a lot of abuse, neglect. And the staffing crisis is certainly, made that much worse. But I'll tell you, the long-term care industry has always understaffed, always. So in a way, they contributed to the situation that we have right now. And I try to bring legislators' attention back to this staffing shortage crisis is creating a care crisis. It's enormous, the impact. I mean, we get weekly reports from the Department of Health regarding complaints that they have investigated. They're shocking. They are just shocking, the sort of situations that we see. One person died of septic shock, because her wound was unattended and infected and pain medications have been stolen from people who suffered enormously because they weren't getting the pain medication. The inhumanity of it is mind-boggling sometimes, really mind-boggling. But oftentimes, you know, it sometimes you've got a staff issue that, yes, it happens. I'm seeing a lot more of this driven by understaffing. And legitimately, there is a crisis now. They have a lot of the staff really can get a much easier job working for McDonald's and probably the same kind of pay. So we're supporting the staff here. We want to really see staff get a livable wage, all of them. And we want to see if we're okay if reimbursement rates get increased, but 90% of it has to go to the care staff. And there has to be an ironclad system that can track where that money is flowing. And of course, the industry doesn't like that. So that'll be a battle we'll have now in this year, this session.
Well, and I think one of the problems that I see, and tell me your thoughts on this, but we've gotten so task-oriented that we're not allowing relationships to grow. We're not allowing staff to befriend somebody and really care like it's their parent or their friend. And when you cut that out, you're missing an awful lot. And families will say the same thing as well. I know when I was caring for my mom and I was task oriented and I liked checking stuff off, it made me feel good like I was accomplishing something, but I was missing so much. And I found I was doing some stuff I didn't really need to do. And, you know, instead of just maybe sitting on the couch next to my mom, even if she couldn't talk, just sharing that space together,
yeah,
you know, that connecting on a human level, when we push that away, and I think a lot of, you know, communities and services have cut that out. You know, you can't take pictures and you can't do this and you can't do that because there has been some abuse, but it's like the bad apple tosses them all out of the bundle then. And those are, to me, that's kind of the glue that makes things work, is letting staff develop those relationships. And
that's what they want to do. The good people really want to do that. I'm just contacted today by a person who was terminated because she called to question some of the practices that were harming the residents. They started retaliating and then let her go, you know, and retaliation too is a big lever that are used by so many. But getting back to your time, most staff want to spend the time, they're distressed that they have to quickly run from one to the next, and they know they're missing, you know, any relationship building time and basic caregiving time even. So I'm very empathetic to many of the staff. Many are great people trying their best in a really impossible situation.
Yeah, I know with my own mom was in a nursing home for 14 years, which is a really, really long time. And there was a great team until like her last 3 years. And on her unit, three staff all left at the same time. They were all friends but they were like glued. They had so much fun. Everybody had fun on the unit. You walked in and it was uplifting. They were laughing. They knew their people. And their information, their data, their personal relationships of likes and dislikes, none of that got transferred. And it was like night and day.
Wow.
From then forward. And it was a whole different experience. I remember going into to the director of nursing because my daughter had gone to, and this wasn't harming my mom per se, but this just shows not using proper protocol, with a like leaf bag of my mom's clothes, because my daughter had gone to clean out my mom's closet, and everything was like ripped in half. Because they weren't doing a two-person transfer that they were supposed to. And her clothes, brand new clothes, were ripped, not even at the seams. And some of the clothes they were still putting on her, and we didn't know because you couldn't see that they were ripped in the bottom because she was sitting in her wheelchair. I mean, hundreds of dollars of clothes. I was so upset and so livid, and there really wasn't a good answer at all. I'm like, so this is why my mom's closet is locked. It has nothing to do with access of other things. It was just hiding that is what it seemed to us as a family.
Yeah.
And yet for years, just wonderful, wonderful care. But that change in staff can make or break things. And, you know, who's in charge, or even hospice. When my mom was on hospice, we had a nurse that refused to follow the hospice directions because she was an old school nurse, and I was livid and I had to leave town. And I'm like, no, you need to follow this. I said, I'm going to put a note on the wall. You can't do that. That's breaking HIPAA. And I said, I don't even want to know how many rules you're breaking right now. You're supposed to be listening to this person's directions. And, you know, you really have to stand up and be forceful at times. And so many people are not comfortable doing that. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, the numbers that you're seeing come in and the stories, I also hear of a lot of stories that never get reported.
Sure.
And so how many are there really? Because you have to have the energy and the emotional bandwidth to do that too. And not everybody has that or the time to put into it and to follow it up, because it doesn't seem like it goes just boom, 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 the way it's supposed to.
Well, you know, as shocking as those numbers are of 22,000 complaints in a year, that's the tip of the iceberg, because we know full well, for the reasons you're pointing out, Lori, people are intimidated sometimes or just don't know how to file a complaint or whether it's a good idea to do it or not. And a lot of them are so fearful of retaliation, they don't dare file a complaint. And I know even for my own dad, there were some things happening that I was concerned about. And I said, well, I'm going to go talk to management. He said, no, please don't. It'll just get worse. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't argue with him.
It's true. My dad was also in the nursing home. He told me staff were kind of belittling him. And I really had faith in the staff and I trusted them. And so I knew my dad was having some issues. He had brain cancer, and I didn't look into it the way I should have. Mm-hmm. After my dad's funeral, I get a letter from one of the staff saying, I know you shared this with me, and I know I said it wasn't happening, but it was. Because she was afraid of her job.
Yeah, sure.
And she said, I'm going to get crying. She said, your dad was like my dad, and I felt awful doing that. But I had to put food on my family's table, you know? And it should never, ever be like that.
No, never.
And again, that's minute compared to what others have gone through. But as a family member, you feel horrible.
The guilt. Yes, I know exactly what you're doing. They protected us as children. Mm-hmm. We want to protect them when they need us. Yeah, and nearly everybody talks about that.
It really is something. Can you talk a little bit, and we've touched on this a little bit, but, you know, some challenges with industry and public perceptions and, you know, politics, that the whole nine yards there?
Oh, wow. Where do you start? You mentioned the politics, and I kind of talked a little bit about how that changed. We're hoping that we can get some significant initiatives underway this year with a DFL, controlled House and Senate and governor's office. The industry, you know, has, first of all, 40 some lobbyists among them, a nice, healthy pack political action committee where they contribute to candidates. But we soon found that's powerful, yes, but nothing's more powerful than a little scrappy nonprofit organization who is out there, you know, putting a spotlight on what's going on. And so the industry really isn't happy with us. They hate Elder Care IQ. I shouldn't speak in blanket because they don't all, but there's some who clearly don't like it. And we've had to be very careful how we roll that out. We'd have to make sure, because liability is a definite concern. I'm not terribly concerned, but But for that reason, we use only the MDH data as it comes. We don't editorialize on it at all. And, you know, with IQ, we launched that, I think it was November 29th. In 1 month's time, there were 6,000 visitors to that site. Mm-hmm. And that really speaks to the need people have for really trying to find out, get beneath the veneer of the nice, pretty lobby and such, you know, and really understand how good is the quality of the care. Because if you believe the marketing materials, I mean, it's nirvana.
Why don't I have you tell everybody what Elder Care IQ is and why that was created?
Good idea. Well, during this time, we would be helping people to try to understand what's going on, and sometimes helping them make choices of where they, you know, might get the best chance at quality care. And one of the only ways for real quality information, especially on assisted living, is the Department of Health investigation data. And it's not something that anybody should use exclusively, but they should factor that into their decision making, which even to web savvy people is very, very cumbersome, confusing, and difficult to navigate. It was about a month ago, I was asked to speak at a Rotary Club meeting, and I talked about this issue and that, you know, our frustration too. It could take us hours sometimes to help people try to get a handle on this. And in the audience was somebody I knew, and I knew he was a techie. But he came to me afterwards and he said, "I can fix this and I'll do it pro bono." And that was Scott Zerbe. And in less than a year, we launched this tool. We're going to continue to work on it. You know, there's some issues, the Department of Health data that we link directly to, so people will go directly and see the investigation reports, read them for themselves. We're not interpreting those. They can interpret that for themselves. And even, you know, if they you know, find that and still want to talk to a place, they have some information to ask them about. What have you done about infection control? How are you handling that? Or whatever, you know, the issues might be. And we got funding from the Stephen Square Foundation to get this base IQ set up. And we're going to continue to build on it. The next thing that we're going to add on this is fine data. How much have they been paid in fines? And add the special focus facilities. Are they on the special focus facility, federal data? And report cards when they become available. So it'll continue to get a lot more robust. And I invite people to go to eldercareiq.org and just cruise around. You can put your zip code in and that'll give you everything in the area, and it gives you everything. If they're licensed, that should be there, and they can see those who have no investigations at all. That doesn't mean that they're not, don't have issues, but it's a good indicator, and they'll see those that have one or two, and then they'll see those with numerous.
Can you tell us what federal focus is? I hadn't heard that term before.
Special focus facilities. Those are nursing homes that habitually are having surveys and findings that are concerning. So, and I would, if they're a special focus facility, I would steer very clear of them, because it's many years of these kinds of significant issues. And then they have another one that's called, I'm not getting the term quite right, but facilities of concern. So they haven't quite risen to that level of being on the special focus, but they're concerning, and they're working with those facilities.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Now, is the Elder Care IQ just for Minnesota?
It is for Minnesota now. We've had people approach us about going to other states, but we need to get Minnesota down pat before we decide if that makes sense or not. And each state's so different, too. So it's not terribly simple, but we're learning a lot and we're getting a lot of feedback. Most of it's good. Some of it is, well, why isn't this on that? And it, you know, we're, you know, dependent on the quality of the MDH data. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, and I think they're doing good, and you know, it's massive. It's a massive job.
Well, let's talk about 2023. What are your plans for that and beyond?
Well, right now we're looking at the legislative session, which, as you've heard, is now in session. We have some threats out there that might see some attempts to take some of these protections away. So we'll be fighting those tooth and nail. And but we're also going to, there's an interesting initiative legislation that Representative Cleavorn is introducing, and it is to create a task force on aging. This state's poorly prepared for this enormous growth in the elder population. And so that could lead to ultimately to a department on aging, or could lead to some structural rearrangements within. But more importantly, it will have a planning focus, which isn't happening now. And we have a very fragmented approach, multiple agencies doing various different things. So we need a lot more cohesion there. There may also be some legislation that's going to mandate financial transparency, especially for the for-profit industry people. So I'm not sure if that's going to go or not, but it's a frustration because how do we verify that they are in the financial aid that, or, you know, need that some say they are, and maybe they are, I don't know, but until you have full disclosure, you don't really know what you're going, and are our tax dollars being spent fairly? And who knows what else will come out of the woodwork. Organizationally, we're going to focus on building out Elder Care IQ. Mm-hmm. And then for Elder Voice, we're going to try to get funding so we can do more consulting, counseling of families and residents having issues too. Or we might partner with some other organizations that are already doing that. And that may make sense. We're looking at a lot of things. I had one reporter say, "Don't you ever rest?" No, actually, we don't.
There's not time for that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, with our $15 billion surplus there, you know, I hope you get funding and to push forward. I hope things aren't pulled back that were passed prior. You know, I personally would like to see education for not only the professional staff and protection, like you said, for kind of the whistleblower type thing, and yep. Get that into the educational process or who, I think sometimes staff don't feel like they can report because they were told they had to give it to their staff. I know of one person in particular who gave it to five different supervisors. Nobody did anything. And she's just like, I'm told I can't go outside. You know, I can't do this. And so I think there needs to be more education on a state level of what their power is and what their alternatives are with that. And I'd love to be able to see more education for families too, of what to look for, because those eyes and ears are so important if we're really going to address this. And that doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be a me versus them thing either. I think there are ways that, you know, your organization and others can work with communities on how do we better address this. But it takes that sitting down and having a conversation about what is going on and getting past kind of almost like the political crap we have going on where it's party lines. This is about people. This isn't about party lines, you know? And so we have to listen to both sides and then figure out a way to do better. And I think so often those lines are set in stone. And when somebody does try to listen, they get their hands slapped because now they're agreeing with somebody else. And that's going to look bad for us as a facility. And it's like, not if you're looking at improving your services, you know, not if you're trying to prevent some of these things from happening. I don't see how you're going to fix those things without having those conversations.
I agree. And, you know, we know there are some excellent providers out there. Mm-hmm. We really do. And I wish there were a way that we could acknowledge who they are, you know, specifically, you know, but as soon as you do that, they can have a management change and everything's different again. So, you know, we hate to mislead somebody. And yeah, and same goes with, you know, if they've got a history of some pretty bad investigation findings, sometimes they make a change that turns things around and resolves what the issues were. But I, you know, I'd have to tell you just, and I haven't done a very extensive look at this, so it's kind of just a review. But when I look at these investigations, it's assisted living with memory care that repeatedly come up. Those are the danger organizations. Those with dementia are so vulnerable and so easily taken advantage of, and some horrible things. So I'm if we can get some money, so I can really go dig into that. I think it'd be very telling where the problem areas are. And you know, though the new law does have specific standards for assisted living with memory care, clearly we're having troubles getting that instilled, embedded into these organizations.
Well, and I think, and I can speak, you know, again, from my own situation with my mom, there were times where I seriously wanted to pull her out, but I also knew how difficult that would be on her to start all over. And as a family member, and I'm probably just admitting this to myself now, I didn't want to kill her by the move.
Yep.
And that goes through your mind, you know, this could kill her. She's going to have to start all over. She's not going to know anybody. At least the routines are set and some of the voices she can recognize, even if not the people. And you're looking at those really minute things and trying to figure out, what do I do here? And it's very difficult. It is.
And it's not black and white. Mm-mm. You know, it's very difficult. I would hope we could have a more constructive dialogue with the industry, to the, you know, the long-term care providers, because we do have good relationships with individual providers, and they are really helpful in understanding, you know, their points of view, and then they listening to our points of view. That helps. But I'm getting more and more concerned about the for-profit organizations. There seems to be an epidemic of problems, care problems, with these large corporate entities. And they're very smart. They know how to avoid accountability. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that actually with Elder Care IQ too, because now that we I'll try to make this simple, but now, a provider used to be that they could, it was the housing services were regulated and then the care services regulated. Well, that legacy is still carrying through, or there's multiple ownerships and they're different than the name of the place that it operates, the facility. It purposely trying to cloud the picture for people not to get a full accurate view of what's really going on.
Yeah, that's well, and that would be interesting too if you could break down that ownership and have that on a thing, because people are looking at the name of the building that they're looking at, and they're not looking at the operational services, or they're not looking at the mothership that actually owns them and what's going on, or how many times they've changed their names and why is that happening?
Yep.
Type deal. So, but again, there are many out there who, do a great job, but this is something when you're dealing with a loved one, you've got to do your homework on this. And it's like you said, the government hasn't made it easy to do. And so I'm very hopeful, with your elder care IQ, that's going to help families and possibly help even staff in terms of where do I want to work?
Well, interestingly, about a year ago, we started Spotlight, what we call Spotlight. And it's taking a deep dive into one of these investigations. Mm-hmm. And if you go to our website at eldervoicefamilyadvocates.org, you can see some of those spotlights. And the Department of Health said they're actually using them for training. Mm-hmm. And which is awesome. Also on Elder Care IQ, we saw a lot of the traffic coming from the actual providers checking themselves out, I'm sure. And that's great because, we'd like to encourage and motivate better care. And if this helps motivate better care, wonderful.
Yep. You just don't want it turning into a Yelp or Google where they're recruiting people to give them little ticks and five stars and things like that, because that system sure has gotten manipulated as well, not just in healthcare, but in all areas.
Well, exactly. The star system is not good. So no, I'm not sure that we'll ever include the star systems, any of them, on this. They're just so flawed.
Well, and again, I think your system could be used as a good recruit tool for people who want to, because that's something that they typically don't disclose. And some staff know to check it out, others don't. But where staff could do that on their own, that could be really interesting, because people don't want to work where things are a mess. And where it's complicated, and where they could end up getting in trouble. That's not what they're typically looking for.
We've seen that, some of the nurses, fretting, I'm going to lose my license because I know what they're telling me to do. Mm-hmm. Not right. And so it's so much to do. And we'd like to really build our relationships with the staff, the direct caregivers too. And whether they're the professionals, licensed people, or the unlicensed, they're all important.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, I'll just mention this quick, and then I want to wrap up and give people your contact information. But again, going back to when my mom was in the nursing home, they always, way back then, they always had family councils. Yeah. And a lot of them don't do that anymore because it's too much work. And they had asked me, would I head one up? And I said, yeah, I will, on one condition. And they're like, well, what is that? I said, I want access to a different director every month. I want housekeeping. I want maintenance. I want nurse. I want social services. I want the administrator. I want the front desk person. And they're like, well, why do you want that? I said, because so many of the issues can be handled if they get to the right person. And I can't tell you how comforting it was for family to be able to talk, and for, laundry to say, oh, we can fix that. Or kitchen go, oh my gosh, I had no idea. That'll be fixed by tomorrow. But avoiding so many of these things and opening up that conversation instead of having that wall between them, where that wall so often is a wall of distrust. And when you can break that down, I mean, we had people volunteering that were master gardeners that saved the budget and enhanced the land. I mean, so many different things transpired because of those things. You know, from the person doing the hair, you know, for residents. I mean, it was amazing. So I think sometimes people think everything has to be really complicated, and a lot of times it really doesn't need to be. It's just figuring out a channel to have that conversation and for everyone to feel safe. So kudos to you, Chris. Gosh, you have gotten a lot accomplished in a very, very short time. And I'm going to keep my eyes peeled on you for what happens this year, you know, with the legislation. And, you know, we've got all that money. I'm sure everybody and their brother's going after you know, that extra, but I would love to see it. They have to do something in healthcare. I mean, on multiple levels, because, or we're really going to be even a bigger mess than we already are.
And Lori, you and I both deal with this all the time, and I wish there were a solution to this ageism. Mm-hmm. It's so a part of why it's so easy to ignore the needs of elders or disabled people. And, you know, if we had the same concern for our elders that we have for our children, the world would be a way better place.
Agree. Well, thank you for your time. If you want to get a hold of Chris, you can email her at Chris, K-R-I-S, at eldervoicefamilyadvocates.org. You can go to their website, eldervoicefamilyadvocates.org. You can also check out eldercareiq.org. And they are on Facebook as Elder Voice Advocates and on Twitter as eldervoice_MN. Their phone number is 952-239-6394. And I would encourage you to reach out to them. If you have a story to tell, maybe you have some extra money that you want to donate to their organization, maybe you'd like to get involved, you know, please do so. Working together, this is the only way we're going to get things done. So again, Chris, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Lori. I appreciate it.
For our listeners, I hope you like, click, and share. Even if you're not in Minnesota, this will give other states ideas of maybe how to collaborate with them and get something like this up and running in their area, and to be able to see the effect and the progression that Chris and her organizations have made here gives me, I know, great hope. So again, thank you all for listening, and we will talk to you next time. Bye now.